Harriet Tubman. Stanley Nelson, we have just 30 seconds. Your career has spanned more than 30 years, more than 30 amazing documentaries. How does it feel to be nominated for your first Oscar?
It feels great. You know, I mean, it feels great. I think, you know, one of the things that's so wonderful about it is that more people will see Attica, you know, and for some people, the fact that we're nominated, you know, is validation and a reason to see Attica. And that's what we want. You know, I think that.
Well, it is long overdue. Thank you so much, Stanley Nelson. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Neil Shabata. I'm Amy Goodman. Please stay safe.
Community Radio, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, in the beautiful Willamette Valley.
Join KBOO every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for Counterspin, a show that provides a critical examination of major media stories and exposes what the mainstream media missed. Counterspin exposes and highlights censored stories, sexism, racism, and homophobia in the news, the power of corporate influence, gaffes and goofs by leading TV pundits, and more. That's every Friday at 5:30 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Did you know that KBOO podcasts all our news and talk shows?
You can find the podcast on KBOO's website, kboo.fm, on Google Play, iTunes, and Stitcher.
Just search for your favorite show and hit subscribe to get all the latest episodes downloaded to your favorite device.
Or search for KBOO on iTunes, Google Play to get all the KBOO podcasts.
Now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland City Council considers a record $56 million police contract. Clark County faces a lawsuit for wrongful death of a black man in a traffic stop. And in international news, President Biden says that Vladimir Putin intends to wage war. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 18th, 2022. I'm Josh Salem. The Russian-Ukrainian situation is heating up even further as Moscow plans multiple nuclear weapons practice launches this weekend. President Vladimir Putin already broke a promise to withdraw some 150,000 troops amassed at the Ukrainian border. Now, Russia's strategic forces have drills planned for a Saturday exercise. This should involve the Crimea-based Black Sea Fleet. Russia annexed the Crimea Peninsula from Ukraine in 2014. In the meantime, the National Atlantic Treaty Organization is sending even more troops to its eastern areas. The United States has deployed 5,000 soldiers to Poland and Romania. Britain is also sending soldiers to Poland and Estonia and has offered ships, planes, and tanks. Germany, the Netherlands, and Norway are sending troops to Lithuania. President Biden planned a call today with multiple international leaders from Canada, France, Germany, Italy, the United Kingdom, and NATO, among others. He also declared that he was certain Putin intends to invade. The U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin just said everything indicates Russia could launch an attack at any time. President Biden said the U.S. believes Russia is engaged in a false flag operation to give it an excuse to invade Ukraine. Ukrainian authorities said intensified shelling by pro-Russian militias in eastern Ukraine is meant to provoke a retaliatory attack by the government. The officer who shot and killed Dante Wright during a traffic stop when she allegedly mistook her gun for a taser was sentenced today in Minneapolis court to 2 years in prison. Kim Potter will be eligible for release after only 16 months. That's well below the 7 years advocated for by the prosecution. Judge Regina Chu cited Potter's remorse and long history in the police force as factors in her sentencing decision. Judge Chu rejected comparisons to former officer Derek Chauvin, saying, quote, "This is a cop who made a tragic mistake," end quote. Potter was convicted by a jury of first-degree manslaughter, and Wright's family hoped her sentencing would reflect her crime. A statement from the family's attorneys read, quote, "The judge's comment at the sentencing showed a clear absence of compassion for the victim in this tragedy and were devastating to the family," end quote. Wright leaves behind a 2-year-old son and a widow. Last February, 30-year-old Genoa Donald was killed by Clark County deputies during an illegal traffic stop. Now, Genoa's family is filing a wrongful death lawsuit against the county. Genoa's mother, Sue Zawacki, and the mother of his 3 children are naming the officer who shot Genoa and the officer who mistook his screwdriver for a weapon in their suit. Additionally, they're suing the county and Sheriff Chuck Atkins for promulgating negligent deadly force policies. Genoa was not the only person of color recently killed by Clark County Police. 21-year-old Kevin Peterson Jr. was shot during a drug sting 3 months earlier, and off-duty police officer Donald Sahota was killed by deputies as he attempted to apprehend a robbery suspect. Incidentally, one officer, John Feller, was implicated in both of those killings. Herman Law Group cites those incidents as evidence of a negligent police culture. According to their complaint, Clark County has a custom, policy, and established practice of failing to train its officers to use only deadly force as a last resort. Genoa Donald was pulled over by Officer Sean Boyle for a broken taillight. When Donald refused to keep his hands out, Boyle threatened to attack Donald with a police dog before punching him in the nose and attempting a pain compliance technique by grabbing Donald's jaw. According to nearby deputies, Donald resisted Boyle but didn't fight back. At that point, Donald's car began to roll forward, and Boyle shot him in the head. No body camera evidence exists from the event, but nonetheless, a team of state prosecutors ruled the killing as justified. Portland's beloved elk statue will return downtown after being removed during the summer 2020 protests. The 122-year-old statue may stand once again at its original post on Southeast Main Street, but the granite fountain that served as its base is too damaged to support it. Professional art conservators removed graffiti and fire damage from the statue, using carbon dioxide blasting for the cost of about $8,000. So far, no final decisions on the placement, base, or return date have been announced by the city. The elk is expected to return late this year or in early 2023. A survey commissioned by the Oregon District Attorneys Association shows a majority of residents oppose the governor's decision to commute sentences of people in prison for crimes committed as juveniles. A majority also said the state is headed in the wrong direction on public safety and that they feel less safe than they did 2 years ago. Nelson Research polled 500 likely voters regarding a wide range of public safety and criminal justice issues. Prosecutors themselves have opposed many recent legislative changes, including limiting crimes eligible for the death penalty and moving juveniles accused of violent offenses from the adult system into the juvenile one. Last fall, Governor Brown made more than 70 persons serving mandatory minimum sentences for crimes committed as juveniles eligible for parole. She is said to be considering releasing another 140 individuals. 56% of those polled oppose commuting the sentences of juvenile offenders. 62% said Oregon's political leadership is too soft on crime. Not all district attorneys support the survey results, however. It has already been called a biased and a negligent work. A recent study showed 30% of Oregonians surveyed had been victims of a crime in 2020. That number is much higher than the national rate. Black, Native American, and gay, lesbian, and bisexual Oregonians report higher rates of being victimized versus the state as a whole. The Portland City Council listened to testimony yesterday on a proposed $56 million labor contract between the city and the police union. As it stands, the contract would provide more clear discipline guidelines for misbehaving officers and plans for collaborating with Portland's Pilot Street Response Program, an unarmed team of community health workers specializing in homelessness issues. Still, the four-year contract carries an exceptionally high price tag. Retention payments for officers and public safety specialists, pay raises for multilingual and college-educated staff, and incentives for advanced training add up to nearly $15 million alone. Most of the rest covers cost of living increases, which were deferred during the pandemic. Those increases are identical with a deal struck between the city and a city workers union in February. The ACLU of Oregon objected to the contract on the grounds the police union offers little in terms of addressing systemic racism. Here's more on the story.
It is important that in every contractual and budget decision involving the Portland Police Bureau, the City Council makes decisions that will create accountability for police officer misconduct and violence. The CBA, as it proposed, especially with a long four-year term, does not do this. Moreover, the minimal concessions made by the Portland Police Association is not worth the over $56 million that the impact analysis projects this collective bargaining agreement will cost Portland taxpayers. For the above reasons, the ACLU of Oregon opposes the City Council's approval of this collective bargaining agreement as it is without changes to it.
Caregivers in Washington State received hazard pay during the pandemic, boosting their hourly income to $20. Now, at-home caregivers are lobbying the state to make that pay raise permanent. With more on the Time for 20 campaign, here's Eric Tegetoff.
At-home caregivers in Washington State have experienced a boost in wages to weather the COVID-19 pandemic. A new campaign is urging lawmakers to make the pay increase permanent. Service Employees International Union Local 775's Time for $20 calls on lawmakers to raise hourly wages for workers who care for people in their homes and long-term care facilities in this year's budget. Julie Sparkman is a home care aide who looks after children who mostly have underlying conditions. Last year, Sparkman was diagnosed with cancer.
There was no time to put off what needed done. And if it hadn't been for hazard pay, I don't know how I would have kept living indoors. Honestly, I took every paycheck that I got and paid a month's worth of rent because I knew I would be out of work for some time.
Hazard pay put about three extra dollars per hour into caregivers' pockets. The temporary increase was set to expire at the end of 2021 for individual providers, but SEIU Local 775 had it extended through March. With the session scheduled to end in March, state lawmakers are beginning to craft the budget. Sparkman says, fortunately, the cancer was caught in time, what she calls the best of a bad scenario. But her situation is not unique.
I know that there are other people walking around right now in a scenario similar to that, for whom immediate action will be the only thing that saves their lives.
Sparkman says workers need to be at their best so they can best care for the state's most vulnerable population.
It translates into safer clients, which is why our jobs exist in the first place. And if we can't take care of ourselves, then how are we taking care of anyone else?
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegetoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
With more on Ukraine and other stories, it's Mary Schuerman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
NATO and allies are helping Ukraine boost its ability to defend itself. Self-defense is a right enshrined in the UN Charter, and allies are helping Ukraine to uphold that right.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said Russia has enough capability to launch an invasion of Ukraine with little or no warning. Meanwhile, the State Department confirmed Russia has expelled a senior U.S. diplomat. In an industrial area on Lake Erie, President Joe Biden discussed the newly passed infrastructure law and noted a recent $500 million upgrade to the Sioux Locks in Michigan, which connects Lake Superior to the rest of the Great Lakes.
7,000 vessels and 90% of our country iron ore moves through these locks every single year. That ore makes nearly all the high-strength steel that goes into U.S.-made cars and appliances.
A judge ruled former President Donald Trump must answer questions under oath in New York State's civil investigation into his business practices within 21 days. Ivanka Trump and Donald Trump Jr. must also comply with subpoenas issued in December by New York Attorney General Letitia James. The FBI is investigating bomb threats against more than a dozen historically black colleges and universities. Texas Representative Sheila Jackson Lee at a hearing to examine the rise of hate groups and violence directed at minority institutions.
Let it be very clear that attacks on students and institutions are attacks on communities and families and surrounding areas.
After Senate Republicans blocked a committee vote on five of President Biden's nominees to the Federal Reserve Board, White House Council of Economic Advisers Chair Cecilia Rouse urged action to curb inflation.
In the near term, the principal tools to curb inflation rest with the Federal Reserve, which is why it is critical to confirm the five highly qualified nominees now.
A University of Illinois Chicago report sheds light on the strain facing many frontline workers combating gun violence. Manhattan Institute senior fellow Rafael Mangual argued soft-on-crime policies have contributed to an uptick in violence.
It really kind of defanged the criminal justice system in a way that I think has led to a real loss in incapacitation benefits, more repeat offenders finding their way back out onto the street quicker.
Hans Menos of the Center for Policing Equity countered communities across the country are reimagining public safety without relying solely on police.
Police are doing too much. I think most police officers that we encounter are going to tell us that. And most community members are saying that same thing, that when they have a mental health call, they don't want a police officer showing up. They want someone who can solve that problem.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Black History and Future Month. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Temperatures tonight will be in the high 30s. Tomorrow will be cold and cloudy, but rain is unlikely. Toni Morrison was born 89 years ago today in Lorain, Ohio. The Pulitzer and Nobel Prize-winning novelist wrote some of the most definitive work of late 20th century American literature. Morrison died in 2019. The quote of the day is from Morrison. Oppressive language does more than represent violence. It is violence. Does more than represent the limits of knowledge. It limits knowledge. Minnesota lawmakers are eyeing an aid in dying bill that could expand end-of-life options for terminally ill residents. With more, here's Mike Moen.
Minnesota lawmakers have a lot on their plates during a shorter legislative session this year, but supporters of an end-of-life option bill hope it gets another look. The current proposal says mentally capable adults who are terminally ill with less than 6 months to live can request, obtain, and take medication to die peacefully in their sleep. Grand Marais resident Carrie Framstead says she became an advocate of the bill following the death of her wife Monica 2 years ago. She says it became clear that cancer treatments were too much for Monica to handle.
She had two wishes, the pain management and being able to have quality of life, and she didn't have either one.
A bill in the House has added sponsors in recent weeks, but it's unclear if it will get a hearing. There's also a companion measure in the Senate. One of the concerns opponents have raised in the past includes taking advantage of vulnerable individuals. But supporters say there are numerous safeguards and requirements in place, including accessing the service through licensed providers. Framstead says supporters still are working through stigma issues, such as people still referring to the option as assisted suicide.
It's a decision you make with your family, your physician, with your friends and loved ones, and they're all there with you together.
Other provisions in the bill say terminally ill people can withdraw their request if they change their mind at any point, and that anyone who attempts to coerce a patient would face criminal prosecution. Healthcare providers who participate and comply are given civil and criminal immunity. Similar laws are in place in nearly a dozen other states. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
Texas laws restricting voter access are already leading to the rejection of midterm ballots, and election officials are reporting threats to their safety and lives. With more on the Texas attack on civil liberties, here's Roz Brown.
Across Texas, early ballots have been rejected for the March 1st primary, causing voter frustration when election officials explained they failed to abide by new laws handed down by Texas legislators. Requests for mail-in ballots were rejected upwards of 40% last month, while many ballots since returned by mail also have been rejected because voters failed to include a required driver's license or Social Security number. David Becker with the Center for Election Innovation and Research says Texas ranks low for election integrity because of obstacles forcing voters to the polls on Election Day.
And by concentrating as much voting into a single period of time, the chance for long lines, the chance that fraud may happen or some kind of cyber attack might happen, having difficulty detecting it has increased.
Last month, Becker launched the Election Officials Legal Defense Network to assist public servants who feel threatened or intimidated with free advice and protection. Becker says his legal network for election officials is necessary because they report fear for themselves and their families.
I can't help but be very saddened by the need for this, that a nonprofit like mine needs to protect these civil servants who have worked often in anonymity. They don't get rich, they don't get famous, to facilitate the voters' voices.
Texas is one of 19 states that passed laws in 2021 restricting voter access. Becker says that makes it harder for a democratic election system that relies upon hundreds of thousands of Americans.
We don't hold a national election. We hold 10,000 small local elections. And we have professional election officials from liberal Democrats to conservative Republicans to everything in between who run that system admirably.
Last week, a federal court ruled that a provision of Texas's new voting law that makes it more difficult to vote by mail is likely violating the Constitution's First Amendment. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
Police in Ontario began arresting protesters today, trying to end a three-week-old traffic siege on the Canadian capital. Officers were observed going vehicle to vehicle along a series of trucks and campers parked on Ottawa streets. Some protesters surrendered on their own, and police arrested two key leaders, leveling charges of counseling to commit the offense of mischief, counseling to commit the offense of disobeying a court order, and counseling to commit the offense of obstructing police. Authorities also sealed off the downtown area to keep outsiders from helping come to the aid of those in the so-called Freedom Convoy. 3 weeks of demonstrations have shut down U.S.-Canadian border crossings, hurt both countries financially, and cost Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau political capital. Trudeau invoked the Canadian Emergencies Act, empowering law enforcement to tow trucks away, make arrests, and freeze bank accounts. Recently, the Canadian government had been accused of letting protesters gain strength. Demonstrations started in protest against vaccination requirements for truckers entering the country. That broadened into criticisms of a variety of COVID-19 precautions. The protesters have harassed Ottawa residents and disrupted flow of auto parts between the U.S. and Canada. No protesters were harmed during the day, though one officer suffered minor injuries. The protesters have received donations from conservatives in the United States. NASCAR isn't known as an environmentally friendly sport, but one team is doing what it can to reduce its carbon footprint. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. At NASCAR races, cars can top 200 miles per hour as they speed around the track. This gas-powered sport is an unlikely candidate for climate action, but one racing team is reducing or offsetting its carbon pollution. Steve Newmark is president of Roush Fenway Kozlowski Racing.
We're not going to be able to avoid using tires. We're not going to be able to avoid, you know, burning fuel when we take our haulers across the country that have our race cars in them. But there were other areas that we identified that we could be more conscious of the impact that we were having on our environment.
So although the race cars still run on gas, Newmark's team began using electric or hybrid vehicles off the track. It consolidated its offices and made them more energy efficient. Emissions the team could not reduce, it offset by buying carbon credits that fund hydropower projects. Newmark says that to highlight these efforts, the team raced an all-white car at Daytona last year to symbolize carbon neutrality.
which is unusual to say the least for our industry, when usually every car has, you know, all sorts of colors that pop and jump out at you.
So Newmark hopes his team can inspire the industry and its fans to reduce their carbon footprints too. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
A settlement between Wabanaki Nations and the state of Maine is being disputed in court, with tribal nations claiming that the state fails to recognize their sovereign status. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A hearing was held this week on a bill to change a tribal settlement in Maine. Advocates say it would remove restrictions in place since the 1980s. Lily Bulkey reports.
The Settlement Act was intended to resolve disputes over land claims, but it left Wabanaki Nations with less legal and regulatory authority than other tribes across the nation. Chief Kirk Francis of the Penobscot Nation says that means they're essentially treated as municipalities rather than sovereign nations. He notes roughly 150 federal laws have passed benefiting tribes since 1980, but Wabanaki Nations have been excluded.
The Wabanaki Nations have spent the last 40 years being treated like second-class sovereigns. We have watched out-of-state corporations come in and thrive by doing the very things we should be able to do but for the Settlement Act.
Almost all attendees at the Judiciary Committee hearing voiced support for the bill, but the hearing ended after 8 hours without a vote. The bill is a product of a task force started in 2019 to study the legacy of the Settlement Act and recommend changes. Chief Clarissa Sabatis of the Holton Band of Maliseet Indians believes LD 1626 would help restore self-determination and self-governance for the Wabanaki Nations.
Without a tax base and limited economic development opportunities, it's difficult to generate private and public funding to supplement already underfunded programs such as housing, health, and social services.
The bill's sponsor, State Representative Rachel Talbot Ross of Portland, cited research that says the structural inequities formed by the Settlement Act have contributed to Maine tribal members experiencing extreme poverty, high unemployment, poor health, limited educational opportunities, and more.
The state of Maine somehow thought that recognizing the full political existence of our tribal nations would somehow diminish us as a state. Whatever the cause for those feelings were in 1980, they simply have not turned out to be true in Maine or in any of the other states.
I'm Lily Bulkey reporting.
Native youth from across the country are gearing up for the United National Indian Tribal Youth Mid-Year Conference taking place in Arizona next week. During the three-day event, attendees will engage in Native youth-led activities, sessions, and cultural sharing. Unity staff member Jared Massey says they're looking forward to the gathering to help encourage young people, especially since COVID-19 has hit Indian country hard. The lineup of speakers includes young Native entertainers.
We really went into the mid-year conference just jam-packed, ready to inspire these youth because, again, we're bringing them back together again for the first time. We're able to confirm DeFerro Wunatai, who's from the Reservation Dogs cast. He'll be there in person. We have Little Mike and Funny Bone, who are also from the Reservation Dogs cast, will be there in person. Brooke Simpson, who is just fresh off of America's Got Talent. And so she'll be coming to do some singing for us in person. We will be having a welcome reception, which is going to be a kickoff pool party, which will feature this Native youth band, who are all Unity alumni. And so we're very excited for that. And they'll be a part of the lineup.
The mid-year gathering kicks off next Friday in Phoenix, both in person and virtually. Unity has worked to foster the spiritual, mental, physical, and social development of Native youth since the 1970s. This week, people across Alaska recognize the contributions of Alaska Native civil rights leader Elizabeth Peratrovich. U.S. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski honored her on the Senate floor Wednesday.
Sometimes we think of Elizabeth Peratrovich as part of our history, but she, Elizabeth, and her husband Roy, and the impact that they had on Alaska and the way that they strengthened our democracy is our current history as well.
In February, Alaska marks an annual holiday in her honor. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 18th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael. The producer is Ethan Sandweiss, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Roz Brown, Anthony Lizowitz, Eric Tegetoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Schuerman, and Mike Moen. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
To Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, you might think you're not smart enough to talk about Ukraine. Especially on U.S. foreign policy, corporate news media seem to suggest that any questions you have that fall outside of their framework are not just dumb, but traitorous. Not earnest, but dangerously naive. Peace? Diplomacy?